On this 31st day of August 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in chapter 3 entitled Karma Yoga, and we are in the last verse of the chapter, text 43. Evam buddhe param buddha.
Evam buddhe param buddha.
Sangstabhyatmanamatmana.
Sangstabhyatmanamatmana.
Jahi Shatram Mahabaho.
Jahi Shatram Mahabaho.
Kama Rupam Durasadam.
Kama Rupam Durasadam.
Translation. Thus knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind and intelligence, O mighty armed Arjuna, one should steady the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence, Krishna consciousness, and thus, by spiritual strength, conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. Purport. This third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is conclusively directive to Krishna consciousness by knowing oneself as the eternal servitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, without considering impersonal voidness the ultimate end. In the material existence of life, one is certainly influenced by propensities for lust and desire for dominating the resources of material nature. Desire for overlording and for sense gratification is the greatest enemy of the conditioned soul. But by the strength of Krishna consciousness, one can control the material senses, the mind, and the intelligence. One may not give up work and prescribed duties all of a sudden, but by gradually developing Krishna consciousness, one can be situated in a transcendental position without being influenced by the material senses and the mind. By steady intelligence directed toward one's pure identity. This is the sum total of this chapter. In the immature stage of material existence, philosophical speculations and artificial attempts to control the senses by the so-called practice of yoga postures can never help a man towards spiritual life. He must be trained in Krishna consciousness by higher intelligence. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports to the third chapter of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita in the matter of karma yoga, or the discharge of one's prescribed duty in Krishna consciousness. Om Agyanata Marandasya Gyanandana Shalakaya Chukshu Unmiditam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master Srila Prabhupada opened my eyes. With the torchlight of knowledge, I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So this last verse emphasizes the use of intelligence. Intelligence is what differentiates us from the animals. The animals also have intelligence, but our developed intelligence gives us an opportunity to control the lower self by the higher self. This is what this whole latter part of this chapter is all about. And the latter part of the chapter began with the question of Arjuna, what is it that impels us to act even against our own best interests? We may know with our intelligence that it's bad for us. Just like I like to give the example of the cigarettes. So many people smoke cigarettes. It's completely obvious. It's right on the pack that it's bad for you, that it could destroy your health. Now they're going to put graphic pictures on the packs. And the companies don't like that. They know that actually may convince people to give it up. But the idea is that even though you read that it's, you know, gives you cancer, very bad for pregnant women, whatever it is, still the you're impelled by your addiction to nicotine to smoke cigarettes. So that's a graphic example, but everything is like that. Everything that we are attracted to in this material world, when we actually engage the senses with the object of the senses, a little bit of our intelligence is covered. And at a certain point, you don't even care. You don't even realize. So you lose the intelligence. You lose the understanding that it's bad for you. So this is just the opposite. Krishna is recommending that we have to understand, first of all, what the situation is. That this enemy, known as material desire, has taken over these strategic points of our being. The mind, the senses, and the intelligence. And so with the superior intelligence. Here he's saying, thus knowing that one is even transcendental to the intelligence, by, here it says, by steadying the intelligence, stunk sabya atmanam, steadying the mind by deliberate intelligence, one can conquer the enemy known as lust. So it's not easy. One has to strengthen the intelligence through the proper association. And that association is in the form of these words that we're hearing. Our only connection, or our overwhelmingly most powerful connection, an important connection with the transcendence is through sound. Sound is what bewilders, and sound is what also enlightens. The sounds that are simply descriptive of the objects of the material senses bewilder us more and more, and we can lose our entire understanding of who we are. And for millions of births, we've been in that illusion. But this particular sound, the Bhagavad Gita, the holy name, the words that Srila Prabhupada has written here, give us a clue about an existence beyond the realm, transcendental to the senses, mind, the material senses, material mind, material intelligence. And with that understanding, we can begin to act in such a way to gradually realize that. And in this way, conquer the demands of the of lust, which has taken over these strategic positions. This nice verse is very pertinent here. I think you know this one, Kama Adina? Kama Adina, Kadina Kadita, Palita, Du, Nideshas, Tesham, Jata, Maina Kadunana, Trupano, Pashanti. Utsurjaitan, Atiyadubate, Sampratam, Labdha Buddhis, Tramayatak, Shadanamabahimam, the Yungswatmadasi. So in this verse, which is composed by a great devotee named Madhavendra Puri, who was the spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya's spiritual master, he took the role of Lord Chaitanya's spiritual master, he says there, practically expanding exactly on this section of the Bhagavad Gita, says, in so many lifetimes, we have been the slaves of kama, etc. Now what's the etc.? Well, the first etc. here is anger. Right? When you're too much involved in trying to fulfill the desires of the senses, you must be frustrated, because the world just doesn't work that way. You don't often always have the opportunity, or if you fulfill it for some time, they become satiated, become discouraged. You try to beat the senses and whip the senses so that they become burned out, and they become sources of pain very quickly. One way or another, you're going to be frustrated. And that's called krodha, or anger in all its different varieties. And then there's also the greed department. We were discussing this that from the 16th chapter. The three gates leading to hell, kama, krodha, tata, lobha, greed. Just see all of the evil that ensues from greed. Greed means that, you know, we want your land, we want your resources. In the olden days, they would also take you and make you a slave, right? So there's been battles going on since time immemorial over these scarce material resources, because people are not satisfied with what they have, you know. Actually, you can live very simply and happily in an agrarian atmosphere with the depending on the cows and the nature, you know. But you can only be satisfied with Krishna consciousness in that atmosphere. Otherwise, that is not intrinsically fulfilling. So, kama, krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsarya, these are said to be the six whips of the mind that are always pushing. Madness, intoxication, envy, these are the different things that infect the mind and keep us reacting in the different modes of nature to things in this world. So here in this verse, in how many different ways and how many different varieties have I obeyed the demands of all of these things? I, the soul, have been helpless. You know, I'm in this body, I don't know anything. And when the tongue says eat, eat. You know, when the sex says sex, you run for that. You know, fear department, okay, then, you know, go for it. It's just going on and on and on, birth after birth. So this is what he's saying. And these slave drivers, they've not shown me any mercy. It's not like if you try to fulfill your material desires, okay, that's enough. There's some satiation at a certain point, but then it comes back redoubled, just like a drug addict. You get some pleasure out of it, but then it grabs you, and then you have to have more and more just to stay sane. You know, the pleasure is going down, but just to maintain equilibrium in your life, you have to have this drug. So it's a hellish situation. So this is the picture he paints on the first two lines. They've not shown me any mercy, but I've been so foolish that I've been unwilling to give them up. you know, we're still, you know, trying to meet the demands of the senses. So now, but he says, Utsrijaitan ati yodapate sampratam labdha buddhi. Now here's this word, buddhe, you see? The intelligence. Now, due to my strengthened intelligence, I am giving them up. I'm not going to obey the demands of those senses. But you cannot remain just doing nothing. You cannot remain just repressing the demands of the senses. You'll go crazy, and eventually you'll lose the battle. Too powerful. Therefore, the last line says, and I'm running to you, O Lord, please engage me in your service. If the senses are not and the mind are not engaged in the service of the Lord, they must be engaged in the service of Maya. So that's our alternative. We have to serve. If you think you're independent, you're just a fool, number one. We're not independent for one moment. Our next breath, are we supplying the air, the power to breathe, the body, all of the things that go into just living another minute? It's all given to us by higher powers. So using that the facilities we have, beginning with our own bodies, our own mind, intelligence, words, wealth, whatever we have, in the service of Krishna, is supreme intelligence. Is supreme intelligence. And Krishna reciprocates. He reciprocates by, first installment, weakening your obsession with the things of the senses. And at the same time, giving you a taste. Giving you the taste of real pleasure. But the soul is contacting the supreme soul, you know, through the means of Krishna consciousness, through the sound vibration, etc. So that's where this intelligence comes in. Evam buddhi param buddha, understanding that you are superior to the intelligence, and that by following, you remember the hierarchy he set up, or he explained, indriyani paranya hundiye bhakparangmanha. There's the sense objects, the senses, the mind, the intelligence, the soul, and the super soul. Now, between the soul and the intelligence is also false ego. False ego is the false sense of who we are. This body, right? How can we help falling into that illusion? You know, everyone's telling us from the moment we're born, our parents are cuddling us, you know, oh, you're ours, you know, you belong to this family. The language comes, you learn to speak before you're five, right? Your language, the color, the place of origin. Of course you identify with the body, that's all you can identify with. And as you go on growing, you say, oh, now I'm not 5 years old, I'm 6 years old now. I'm seven. No, you're not. Your body is 7 years old, but you're not, you're eternal. You're millions of years old, every one of us, right? In fact, we're infinitely old. So, so we're in this deep illusion based on the body and relationships to other bodies and places where we were born, the language, the culture, the history, you know? I was born into a Jewish family. Oh, you have a Jewish soul, you know, isn't it? Oh, wonderful, you know, special. You know, complete ignorance. And the whole thing is this culture. We belong to this land. Here's Israel, you know, go way back. Here's Abraham, you know. You have some relationship. I don't have any relationship to him. You know, soul is just, to the next, previous body I could have been Chinese. Next body I could be a mosquito. Where's my relationship to some guy 5,000 years ago? You see the ignorance? It's silliness. So this is intelligence. Identifying ourselves who we really are. Once we understand, what is that, swarup? It's called the swarup. Rup means form, and swa means your own. What is my real form? Not this changing, you know, bag of blood and bones. What is my real form as a soul? And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu answers. You know that one? Jivera swarupoi?
Nitya Krishna.
Krishnera Nityadas. Yeah. So this is a very important verse. The very first instruction that Lord Chaitanya gives to Sanatana Goswami, his one main disciple practically. He taught him for 30 days, I think it was. So he says, Jivera Swarupoi Krishnera Nityadas. Let's see what this means. The jiva, the soul, not the body, but the real soul, the conscious being, his swarup, his real form, eternal form, not this changing form, is to be eternal servant of Krishna. That's what he says. You know? So in our present condition, we're not doing that. You know, we're a million miles from that understanding. So that's where the intelligence comes in. Understanding that, okay. Then the question is, how do I act in that relationship? Just understanding it is not enough. You have to also act. And that's why, you know, the senses, mind, intelligence all have to be employed. And then when you start acting in that way, it's just like, you know, if you're an amnesiac, you know, you get hit on the head, right? You don't know your name or where you work or anything. You forgot. So if someone knows you, they're trying to, nurse you back to your ordinary state. What are they going to do? Take you back to where you were, try to introduce you to the old things, you know, remind you of what you were. And then you have to start acting in that way, right? Or suppose you're at a masquerade, you know, a Halloween party or something, and you're taking the role of Napoleon or whoever, you know, Davy Crockett, whatever, you know, and then you get hit on the head, and the only identity you know is your masquerade. Oh, I must be Davy Crockett. You look in the mirror, and you're that's me, right? No, that's not you. That's just a costume. You have a real identity. So someone who's your friend is going to say, get out of that costume. That's not really you. You know, you have this whole other identity. And they have to remind you and show you. And then you have to actually act in that other identity. So that's what bhakti yoga is. We are all wearing these costumes. This is not us. You know, and we're totally convinced that this is who we are. Isn't it? So, therefore, we need training. We need training to train first the intelligence to understand, yes, absolutely, we are servants of Krishna. Now, so what do I do? Here's what you do. Now you hear Krishna's name, you chant Krishna's name, you serve the deity, you do all the things that we do in that identity. And gradually, it starts to feel right. That's really who we are, who I am. It makes perfect sense. And unlike these other identities, these which are so frustrating because they're unnatural, this identity feels completely natural. That's why you find, you know, 5-year-old, 10-year-olds, 20, 30, 50, 60, 70, and 80-year-olds being happy just serving Krishna. But you don't find 80-year-olds being happy and, you know, trying to serve the senses. I went to visit Brajavadu. You know Brajavadu? Brajavadu Dasi is Srila Prabhupada's oldest living disciple. She's 97 years. She'll be 97 in December. And 97? No. Should be 98. And she's there in this home, you know. And, oh my God, you know, you really see firsthand what old age really, really means, you know. Here are these people, so many have dementia. You know, they don't remember who they are, or some woman was just babbling nonsense on, you know, straight on. And, barely walk, you know, be able to walk. They can't walk. They're moving around. And just one after another. And, she's in that, we don't have a Krishna conscious home for her, but we visited her, we had a little kirtan, gave her some prasadam, you know, she was very overjoyed. But you can see, this is what comes. This, when you talk about birth, old age, disease, and death, it sounds very glib, but this is what you're talking about, you know. And birth, though, we forgot. Birth is like horrible. To be cramped up in that thing and then to become, it's one thing if I'm completely unconscious, that's okay. But then after 7 months, you wake up. You start dreaming and you're somewhat aware of your situation. It's described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. You may not have read that yet. In the third canto, how the soul in the womb, in the human womb, of course, becomes aware and starts praying to the Lord. It says, oh, what a mistake I've made. You know, I didn't serve you in the last life. And so this time I'm really going to be serious about coming to Mangalarti and chanting my rounds. You know, just see what happened. And 2 months that goes on. 2 months, 2 whole months, you imagine. But then in the trauma of birth, if you don't have the piety, the credits to be born in a devotee family, you'll be born in an ordinary family, and you forget everything, of course, and then you'll be trained up as just an ordinary materialist. And off we go again, misidentifying under the sway, the masters of lust and anger and greed, you know. So this is our situation, our real situation. And here's the formula, beginning of the formula, the outline of how we can escape or be released. And the key element is strengthening the intelligence and the will through proper hearing from proper sources. And then using that intelligence to control the lower self and engage it in the service of Krishna. And then this lust can be mitigated. This material desire can gradually decrease. And what is it replaced to? Replaced with? It's replaced with the desire, the overwhelming desire to serve Krishna, to hear about Krishna, to chant about Him. If we go ahead a few chapters, We'll see that Krishna, in his essential verses, beginning in chapter 10, text 8, 9, 10, and 11, in the second verse, he describes how those who are intelligent, you know, aham sarvasya bhavavo mattak sarvam bhavartate itimad vabhajante mam buddha bhavasamandrita. The word Buddha and the word buddhi and buddhe are the same word. It means someone who's infused with transcendental intelligence. So he says, he basically says, I'm God. Everything's coming from me. I've created everything. You know, he's always explained that, how all his energies and he controls them and everything. Okay, those who understand that, who have faith in those words, they worship me with all their hearts. Those who are intelligent, Buddha. How do they do that? Mat chitta mat gata prana bodhiyantak parasparam katayantastamam nityam tushanti chadamanticha. Here he gives a very, you know, a little summary. Everything is very concise here. The Gita has to speak it very quickly. So he says, mat chitta, first thing is placing the mind on me. They think of me. And mat gata prana means, basically, you know, it's a graphic description. The life air, their life air comes to me. In other words, they use all their energy in serving me. Madgata prana. And bodhi yantak parasparam. They're always hearing and chanting about me. They're describing me, glorifying me, making plans how to increase the service. You know, this is all called bodhi yantak, consultation, back and forth. Hearing it. And katayantashtamam nityam. They're always talking about me. They're glorifying me, repeatedly. And tushyanti. In this way, they become very satisfied. And romanti. They enjoy spiritual happiness. You read the Chaitanya Charitamrita. This whole movement really has the spirit of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. The Chaitanya Charitamrita is a book written in Bengali and Sanskrit by one of Lord Chaitanya's chief followers, who wasn't a contemporary but came right after him. He's known as Krishnadas Kaviraj. Kaviraj means the king of poets. So they get this title when they're really good at poetry, Bengali and Sanskrit poet. So he was a great poet and learned scholar. And he wrote this about Lord Chaitanya's life and his teachings. And it's the most authoritative book, especially on the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Srila Prabhupada wrote a book of that name, gleaning the teachings from that Chaitanya Charitamrita and publishing it in one volume. Otherwise, it's a multi-volume work. So you read that Chaitanya Charitamrita, and you'll see, what did Lord Chaitanya do? How did he show? Because Krishna comes as Lord Chaitanya to show how to be the perfect bhakta, devotee, in this age. It's all centered on the chanting. So much of the Chaitanya Charitamrita describes these ecstatic kirtans, whether it's in front of Lord Jagannath, or Lord Chaitanya on the road in South India, or in Navadvip with his intimates within Srivasa's house, you know, or on the road, anywhere. It's going on. In the temples, it's all chanting, chanting, chanting. A lot of chanting. But it's more than that. See, you also have the intelligence. You know, it's a perfect unification of the head and the heart. The ultimate goal of our process is bhakti. Bhakti is love for Krishna. It's really emotional. It's an emotional state. You look at what's going on in Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan, or in what we call Boma Vrindavan, the Vrindavan that's in India, when Krishna was here 5,000 years ago. And it's really a series of emotional, intense emotions in relation to Krishna. There's love, there's fear, not for themselves, but that Krishna's hurt. You know, Kaliya comes. Just imagine, you go down to the bay here, and all of a sudden, from that bay, comes a multi-headed, huge serpent, like a big dragon, you know, suddenly appears. And within the coils of that dragon is the one you love the most, you know, whoever it may be. Isn't that scary? You know, what would you feel, you know? And the kind of love that they had for Krishna is not even imaginable to us, you know. It's just like it was everything, their life air, you know. And then suddenly, you know, he's just this delicate little boy, and he's in the grips of this horrible snake, you know, poisonous snake, that just the fumes coming out of that lake, and the birds are dying and falling. You know, now they didn't know he's God, so naturally they thought he was a goner, you know. So they're all crying and lamenting, you know, rending of clothes and tearing of hair, you know. And Yashoda the other day just wanted to go in. You know, they didn't care if it was poison. They want to try to save Krishna. So, you know, this is a high emotional state of deep, you know, black depression and anxiety. And then afterwards, 2 hours, I think, and that's, he finally saw that they were, you know, on the point of death, practically. And he breaks out of the coils, and he jumps up on these multi-hoods, and he starts dancing. And, you know, the demigods are playing the drums and everything. It's a musical. And he's suddenly dancing and punishing the snake. And it goes on, and they see that, you know, and finally the snake is punished like that. But you can imagine the whipsaw of the emotion, you see, the intense emotion. The whole point is it's different varieties of extreme pleasure. Even though it seems like a negative emotion of fear for Krishna's safety or, the mood of separation, longing for his presence and he's not here, it seems like the worst kind of agony. And on the material side, it is. You know, the whole blues culture and so many novels and poems. Shakespeare, you know, it's all the separation. Oh, you're gone. I loved you once. You're dead. Or you're gone, you know. Isn't it? You know, that's this intense emotion. There's no pleasure there, ultimately. It's just like pain, agony. But in Krishna consciousness, any emotion, intense emotion directed toward Krishna, is a source of great pleasure. Now, of course, he has these enemies who hate him. That's not really bhakti. That's another thing. But when it's based on love, it produces... And this is what Lord Chaitanya is doing. So that now back to our Bhagavad Gita. Right? Krishna says, Tushyanti cha damanti cha. You know, by speaking about me. Katayantashtamam nityam. They're always chanting my glories. And we have this beautiful poetry. It's endless. The Bhagavad Purana, the writings of the Goswamis. You know? And it's expanding as we speak. Devotees are writing all over the world. You know, the internet is abuzz with kirtan. You know, if you know where to find it, if you want that. So anyway, this is where the devotees enjoy the pleasure, and that pleasure completely destroys lust. It just destroys it. In fact, it's the same pleasure energy that's been turned into love for Krishna. So that's real use of intelligence. And this last verse, I mean, I've kind of expanded on it, but that's really what it means. And this yoga process, and in the next verse, which is the first verse of the next chapter, Krishna will say, this is eternal. I spoke it to the sun god millions of years ago. The process by which you can strengthen the intelligence, focus the mind on Krishna, overcome the bonds of lust, anger, and greed, etc., and ultimately... You know, leave this material body and this material world for the last time, not coming back to another material body, and return to our original swarup, our original identity in the spiritual world. That's the whole program. So, any questions on this? And then after that, we'll just do a quick review of this chapter. This is the important section to study, beginning in text 36 and going to 43. We have 8 verses there. All right, let's go through some of the chapter. Now, the chapter began with Arjuna kind of asking Krishna to resolve a doubt, that the confusion he had. Because chapter 2 ended with Krishna seemingly to being exalting and praising peace and just being in a state of nirvana. He uses that word nirvana. Brahma nirvana is practically the last word in the chapter 2. So Brahma nirvana, it doesn't sound like fighting in a battle. You know, so Arjuna is expressing a certain bewilderment here. That first, you say, you want me to fight this battle, and then you say, well, you want me to be peaceful and be in Brahma Nirvana. Well, how are those reconciled? So he says, why do you want me to engage me in this ghastly warfare if you think that intelligence is better than food of work? Because the whole last part is on fixing your intelligence. You're becoming calm, equal poise, and happiness and distress. It doesn't sound like a battlefield. You know, it sounds like yoga. So Arjuna says, it's kind of confusing to me. How you want me to work so, be on the battlefield and fight, and then also to be in samadhi and Brahma Nirvana? How is that? You know, what is that all about? My intelligence is bewildered by your equivocal instructions. Therefore, please tell me decisively which will be most beneficial for me. In other words, he thinks it's either or. Either I can be in Brahma Nirvana, have steady intelligence, or I'm going to fight this battle. But you want me to do both? I don't see how I can do it. So Krishna starts to explain, and this is called Karma Yoga. O sinless Arjuna, I've already explained that there are two classes of men who try to realize the self. Some are inclined to understand it by empirical philosophical speculation, and others by devotional service. So this is the Jnana Yogis, he's saying, and the Bhakti Yogis. But really, they're equivalent, ultimately. So then he says, you can't just stop working. You know, it's not that you're just going to sit and meditate and stop the senses. Just to by abstaining from work, you don't achieve naishkarmya. Now, this naishkarmya is important to focus on a minute. Naishkarmya is a state where you work, but you don't get any karma. In other words, good or bad. There's no residual, you know. If you work in the material world, even if you're a very pious person, and there are those who just work for others, basically very charitable, they're good people. Still, that's karma. You know, that's good karma. And you have to come back in order to get your good karma. In other words, I'm very charitable, so I'm due to get, you know, become very rich the next life. All right, got to take birth. Got to die, you know. So ultimately, that kind of karma, it's not good. It's, you know, it's relatively good compared to bad, but it's all bad. But naishkarmya is the state in which you're acting and living, but you're not accruing any good or bad karma. In other words, you're on your way to liberation. But here he says, you can't just stop working and expect to have naishkarmya. That's not how it works, you know. And the next verse he says, you can't stop working even for a moment. Even if you're sitting there, the senses are completely still, the mind is maybe going a mile a minute, right? That's work. That's work. That's also activity. So he says, and just to maintain the body, you have to do something. So forget about stopping work. That's not feasible. You have to find a way to work in such a way that you don't incur karma, and you stay in Brahma Nirvana, and your intelligence is fixed on Krishna. That's the art of work. So he goes on. Text 6. One who restrains the senses of action, but whose mind dwells on sense objects, certainly deludes himself and is called a pretender. So you can't fake it. Krishna knows from within, you know, what your real state of consciousness is. You may be sitting there like some yogi, you know, but actually in you know, thousands of yoga studios all over the country, the meditation is going on, but the meditation is, oh, what a nice yogini next to me. And she's thinking, yeah, pretty nice yogi, you know. In other words, they're pretenders. They're not getting the real result of yoga. Better, on the other hand, if a sincere person, text 7, tries to control the active senses by the mind and begins karma yoga in Krishna consciousness without attachment, he's by far superior. In other words, better to do something, you know, and do something for Krishna. Act. Don't be, you know, pretend to be a great meditator and transcendentalist. Do something practical, you know, with the senses. And in this way, gradually, you'll purify. So then this is whole thing of prescribed duty. What do we do? Well, there's a format for that, you know, according to our psychophysical nature, our place in Varnashram. So that text 8, perform your prescribed duty, for doing is better than not working. One cannot even maintain his physical body without work, so you have to do something. And then text 9, which is kind of a key text in the chapter. Yagyartar kamanonyata. You have to work for sacrifice. If you work for selfish motivation, you'll be bound up. Work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu, and here it comes from the commentation. For Vishnu has to be performed, otherwise work causes bondage in this material world. Therefore, son of Kunti, perform your prescribed duties for his satisfaction, and in that way you'll always remain free from bondage. So here, in this purport, Prabhupada makes it clear that the supreme yajna of this age, Krishna Kumar, what's the most important yajna that we perform? Sankirtan yajna, you know. It includes everything. It's in the form of a sacrifice, but really it's not that difficult a sacrifice. I mean, in olden days you had to build up mountains of grain and ghee. You had to hire, you know, qualified Brahmins. You know, they had Brahmins. You have to chant the mantras exactly right, you know, in unison. And then you had other whole bunch of Brahmins who were referees for the Brahmins who were chanting. And if they make a mistake, they say, wait, we have to fix that. Imagine how much it costs. You know, the Brahmins, of course, are austere, but, you know, you have to give them cows, you have to give them grain, you have to give them sometimes wives. It's a big expense. It's very difficult. Yeah.
I do see a lot of parallels, though. Like in kirtan, when we're dancing and singing, it's quite a science, actually, like a yajna. You have a drummer and you have a singer and everything like that. And there's, like, Giraj, when he's here, he's the referee, he's making sure you're playing his
yeah.
Like this.
Yeah. But the whole thing, you know, but really, you know, the sacrifice, does it feel like a sacrifice? I mean, if you really get into kirtan, it's a pleasure. You don't feel like it really is as much of a pain, you know. But it's a sacrifice. You're not doing so many other things. And you really feel, you know, more of a sacrifice as you go outside. You know, like it goes to book distribution. That's a big sacrifice, you know. And, you know, we go out there. But at the end of the day, yeah, are you a little tired, you know, take a little prasadam. But you may have a sore foot or a sore throat. But that, you know, it's basically just pleasure. So that's the sacrifice of the age. But it has to be done for Vishnu. That's the idea. Otherwise, whatever you do is going to bind you to this world. So then he says, and then he has a little interlude here where he says this yajna or sacrifice began with the creation, with Brahma. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods along with sacrifices for Vishnu. And blessed him, be thou happy by this yajna, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable. So the point here is that even just to live in this world, you have to perform sacrifice. And people are doing it every day. They're getting up, you know, at 4 o'clock sometimes, get on the road, travel 2 hours. They're sacrificing. For what? Oh, make money, support the family. You know what I mean? People, you know, men are sacrificing for their family and vice versa. It's going on. Otherwise, without sacrifice, what do you have? You have just a bunch of totally egotistic people just working for themselves? What kind of society is that? So sacrifice is central to any kind of civilization. And, you know, real sacrifice is that which aims to please the ultimate master of the sacrifice, which is Krishna. And then, you know, that idea of watering the root. If you water the root of existence, then everyone becomes satisfied. So if you satisfy Krishna, then ultimately everyone has become satisfied by your sacrifice. Whereas if you're just sacrificing for your wife and the wife is sacrificing for the husband, it's very insular. You see, it's limited. So then the demigods, okay, if you sacrifice, they'll, you know, shower down enough water, not too much, like they got on the East Coast, right? Huge flooding. You know, it has to come at the right place, at the right time, in the right amount. Otherwise, you know, these natural things are cause suffering. They're part of the threefold miseries. So it's all under the control of higher beings. People don't recognize that. They didn't think it was a mystery that they had an earthquake and a hurricane within 1 week. Even Michelle Bachmann could tell that this was, you know. I mean, there's obviously, you know, an intelligence punishing for all the sins. All right, going on. then this important verse, text 13, about prasadam, that santas, that's the saints, the devotees, they eat the remnants of sacrifice. It's like the prasadam is the remnants of the sacrifice of cooking and offering and everything. You become free from all the sinful reactions. Otherwise, if you cook only for yourself, you're eating only sin, even if you're vegetarian. What to speak of meat eaters. All right, then these two verses, 14, 15, even if you just want to eat, you have to worship, you know. You have to have rain to grow the grain. Where does the rain come from? It comes from sacrifice. You think it just comes from the clouds? You know, sacrifice is born of your prescribed duties. Prescribed duties are given by the Shastra. The Shastra is coming from Krishna. Therefore, if you don't perform Sankirtan, you know, you can't even eat. You know, so everything is resting on that. People don't realize that the prosperity that they're enjoying now is due to sacrifices they performed in previous life or lives. But then when you finally run out of your pious credits, that's when the droughts come and that's when the war comes and the disease and the pestilence and the collapse of the economy and everything. You know, it's because your pious credits have run out. They don't connect, you know. They're just thinking of the immediate cause. But this is the broad-minded. The Mahatma sees the broad causes of things. So then in 16 he says, you have to follow this cycle of sacrifice for the gods, and the gods will please you. For Krishna, and Krishna will reward you. Otherwise, if you live a life of sin, agayur indriyaramo, indriyaramo means pleasure of the senses. It's a life of sin. Aga, ayur. Ayur means life, agum means sin. And is mogam. It's useless. It doesn't mean anything. It's just animal life. You're not going anywhere. Text 17. But for one who takes pleasure in the self, whose human life is one of self-realization, satisfied in the self, for him there's no duty. In other words, if you're already self-realized and God-realized, then the ordinary rules and regulations don't apply to you because everything is automatically done as a sacrifice for Vishnu. Every breath is dedicated to Vishnu. And he's guiding you from within about everything. But for those who are fighting against their material side, we need rules and regulations. We need prescribed duties. We need what to do, where to go, you know, and all these things. So that's text 17. Such a person has no purpose to fulfill, discharge. But still, then he says, So therefore, Arjuna, this is a therefore verse, you can always focus on those. Without being attached to the fruits of activities, one should act as a matter of duty, for by working without attachment, one attains the Supreme. So this is a way of becoming detached, vairagya. Text 20, then he gives an example of a king who attained perfection, and just by performing his prescribed duties. And the idea is that you are a good example. You know, if you act in such a way that's a good example for others, that's very important for society. Whatever the great person does, that verse comes up next in text 21, the common men follow. That's why, you know, when you have a Clinton or you have a Bush at the head, it's disaster. These guys are totally unfit to be leaders of anybody, you know. And people follow their examples. Oh, sex in the Oval Office? Okay, you know, let's do it everywhere. Do it in the road. That was 1960s. They're still doing it. Has it made them happy, peaceful? No. So that's the next verse. Whatever the great person does, common men follow whatever stances he sets. Let's see what's going on. So then Krishna gives himself as an example in 22. I don't have any duty to perform, but I still act. In Dwarka, he was getting up, he was, you know, meditating, he was going to work, you know, going to the sabha and consulting, helping to run the... Because if he didn't do it, then no one would do it. That's what he says in 23. If I didn't do my duties, then they would follow my path and I would be the cause of ruin. Text 24. The whole world would be with the ruination. I would be the cause of creating an one population. I would thereby destroy the peace of all living beings. So this was Arjuna's argument why he didn't want to fight. Remember? He was saying, if I fight, I'll kill all the men, the women will be unprotected, and what will happen? They'll be exploited by unscrupulous men, and unwanted progeny will come. For those who care about society and the welfare, they're very concerned that the children are brought up properly, with proper education, under proper care, with enough love and concern. Otherwise, the whole society suffers. What do they got now? You know, the flash mobs? You know, who are these kids? They're mostly black kids in cities like Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, New York. What are they doing? They got no work. They're brought up with no father, no schooling. They drop out of school. They probably haven't been in jail some part of their life. And then what happens? Then they're in a society, you know? And so they got the BlackBerry. Okay, let's meet down in Nordstrom's, you know, we'll break some windows. And boom, there they go. This is called Varna Sankara. And it's a terminal state for any society. When you have all of these young people growing up, no jobs, no work, no education, of course you're going to have growing your homegrown Visigoths and Huns. They're like the last days of Rome here. They don't have to come over the Canadian border and the Mexican border. We're growing, we're homegrown. Our own barbarians. You know. Text 25. As the ignorant perform duties with attachment to results, the learned may similarly act, but without attachment, for the sake of leading people on the right path. So this is again the idea of the self-realized acting as examples for others. The acharya principle. You know, again, reiterating, what is an acharya? Acharya means activity, achar. So acharya has these three qualities, because we call Prabhupada the founder acharya of this movement. You know, very important. He's the founder, and he's also the example of how to be a perfect devotee. That's the acharya. So an acharya, a genuine acharya in our line, he knows the shastra, backwards and forwards, lives according to its tenets. That's not tenet, that's a person in an apartment. A tenet. And teaches. Three things: knowing, living, teaching. That's the spiritual master. So then he says in 26, don't disrupt the minds of the ignorant, you know, by trying to meditate somewhere and give up your duty. Perform your duty in the spirit of devotion and detachment and sacrifice, and engage people in similar work if possible. Then very important verse, text 27, often quoted as one of the main verses in this chapter. Prakriti Kriyamanani, that everything's being done by prakriti, by nature. But the foolish soul, it's being done by the modes of nature, the foolish soul in ahankar. This is I think, the first mention of this word. Ahankar means the false sense of self. I am the doer. I am the owner, the enjoyer, the doer of activities. That's vimudhatma. If the soul is bewildered by such false ego, he's thinking, I'm the doer. I'm the only doer. I'm the main actor in this whole play, you know. Forget the demigods, forget Krishna, forget all the higher forces that are making it possible for me to just take my next breath. I'm the master, and if I'm the doer, I'm the owner, and I'm the enjoyer. This is the solidifying false ego. His character, one of these phrases, as hopefully you'll learn as time goes on, aham mameti, I, aham, mama, and my. This is, I am this body, and the things in relation to the body are mine. Right? And the things that this body has a name, and the bank account has my name on it, and this is mine. You see, for my enjoyment. That's called the essence of ahankar. So that's called vibhutatma. That's complete bewilderment. Nothing is ours. Everything belongs to Krishna. One who is in knowledge of the absolute truth, text 28, Almighty M1, does not engage himself in the senses and sense gratification, knowing well the difference between the work in devotion and the work for fruitive results. So this is a wise person, a tattvavit. Bewildered by the modes of nature, ignorant fully engage themselves in material activities and become attached, but the wise should not unsettle them, although these duties are inferior due to the performer's lack of knowledge. So in other words, act in such a way that you're seeming to act in an attached way. Do it in a detached way, and gradually, by your own example, show how to live in this world in a Krishna-conscious way. This is what's going on. So then, this nice verse, text 30, Prabhupada says, this verse clearly indicates the purpose of Bhagavad Gita. As soon as I read that first line in the purport of text 30, I said, oh, this is worth memorizing. I memorized it many years ago. Surrendering all your works to me, with full knowledge of me, without desire for profit, with no claims to proprietorship, and free from lethargy, fight. So this is a perfect, you know, verse about, oh, okay, this is what we should do in, every day in Krishna consciousness. You know, try to be in that mood. No lethargy. And fight. His duty was fighting. Our duty may be cleaning, cooking, selling books. Those who execute their duties according to my injunctions, follow his teaching, without envy, become free from bondage. But those who, out of envy, disregard these teachings, do not follow them regularly, are to be considered bereft of knowledge, befooled, ruined in their endeavor for perfection. So it's in, this is an either-or proposition. If we accept Krishna's instructions here and try to act in the mood of sacrifice for his pleasure, we'll be eventually become free, we'll become liberated. Otherwise, we'll be bound up. And then he says, you have to act. You can't, there's no point in repressing. You know, you have to act, so act in a proper way. Text 34, there are principles to regulate attachment and aversion. One should not come under the control of such attachment and aversion because they're stumbling blocks. Better to describe your duties than try to do the duty of another. And then Arjuna asks this question, which begins the lust section. And it's very pertinent because one may know all of this stuff, right? Now there's a tattva of it I know, but still the senses are so strong that they drag you away. They act in such a way that you're against your own best interests. So what is that force? Oh, it's lust. You see, it's material desire. So knowing isn't enough. One has to know and act on the basis of that knowledge. And then one can come to the point of actually conquering over the lust. And now we've run out of time. So on Monday we'll begin chapter 4. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.